authorities. Fortunately, their organization had penetrated the police and security agencies of most industrialized countries years before, scuttling investigations into Iron Syndicate activities. Otherwise, they might all be in jail by now. Or dead. If he were in charge, the Czech thought, he would have abandoned the kill list before it even began. Revenge for its own sake was bad for business. But the Czech was resigned to his fate. As long as the targets lived and Vasilev breathed, the list would drive everything to the exclusion of far more pressing business opportunities. The Czech briefly considered killing his Bulgarian overlord when this madness fell on him, but quickly dismissed the idea. Vasilev had a personal security system that amounted to mutually assured destruction. If Vasilev died of any suspicious causes before his time, a secret network of assassins would avenge his death, targeting first and foremost the Czech, the heir apparent to the coveted throne, even if he wasn't at fault. This incentivized the Czech to guarantee Vasilev's security at all costs. The only other solution to end Vasilev's kill list madness was to finish the job as quickly as possible before it ruined them all. Vasilev grunted a laugh. "You're a good friend, and a good liar. The syndicate will be in good hands when you take the reins." The Czech nodded his appreciation. "Thank you." The Bulgarian darkened. "But know this. Rhodes must die before I do. Or else." The Czech nodded grimly, and what little hope he had drained away. "I understand." The death of Rhodes was clear enough. It was the "or else" that truly disturbed him. It was Vasilev's cryptic promise to reach out from even beyond the grave and slaughter him and everyone he loved if he failed this last assignment. He feared Vasilev more than any other man he ever knew, living or dead, despite their decades of friendship. His dying boss was the former head of the Murder Bureau, the highly secret assassination division within the now-defunct Bulgarian Committee for State Security. Vasilev's talent for killing was surpassed only by his raging vengeance against those who either betrayed or failed him. Together, he and Vasilev had formed the Iron Syndicate at the end of the Cold War, along with several other comrades in other security services in the former Soviet republics, transforming their murderous skills and intelligence resources into a vast criminal network that now included many Western colleagues. Vasilev had led them all from the start, and the Czech was now next in line. But only if he completed this final assignment. "And the last man, do we have a name?" Vasilev asked. The Czech leaned forward, smiling. "Yes, we learned of it just 2 days ago." "Who is it?" The Czech told him. Also the man's employer, and the direct connection to Tervol Zvezdev, Vasilev's adopted son, butchered and parted out like cat food last year. The Americans found pieces of his massacred body fermenting in a kimchi jar. Some sick kind of joke. No one connected to Zvezdev's horrific death was laughing now. Vasilev had made a kill list of those he held responsible for Zvezdev's death, including the North Korean who was shot by firing squad by his own government on an unrelated matter less than a week after Zvezdev was found. The inability to wreak his own vengeance on the Korean enraged Vasilev, and only made the killing of the rest of the list more urgent for him, and, consequently, the entire organization. 10 had been disposed of so far. Only 2 remained. Rhodes, and this last man. Vasilev's eyes widened with hope. "And?" The Czech hesitated, his smile frozen. "We have his place of business, his home, and even his favorite restaurant under constant surveillance." "And he's still alive?" Vasilev suddenly coughed, the first of a long, jagged tear of seal barks and throat rattles as yellow sputum gurgled up out of his cancerous lungs. The check helped him sit up as Vasilev's face reddened, long strings of viscous spittle dribbling from his thick lower lip. The check reached for a plastic tray near the bed and held it up to Vasilev's mouth, trying not to vomit himself as he watched the old Bulgarian spit up gobs of bloody mucus into the vessel. The Ghanaian nurse suddenly appeared in the doorway, her eyes wide with worry.
"Is everything okay? Get out!"
Vasilev screamed at her as he battered away the plastic tray, scattering the liquid filth across the floor, barely missing her.
"I'll come back later,"
she offered meekly, and dashed back out of the room. Vasilev gasped for air with the exertion. The Czech gently lowered him back onto his bed, then reached for a tissue to wipe the man's mouth, but Vasilev pushed his hand away.
"I want him dead,"
Vasilev said, his chest heaving. His bloodshot eyes stared vacantly at the far horizon of the trackless sea. The Czech carefully wiped the sputum from his own hand with the tissue.
"The man travels. He could be anywhere."
Vasilev's bloodshot eyes narrowed. He was still gasping for breath.
"I want his head in a box, in my hands, before I die. I have our best people on it. Fuck your best people, and fuck you, if you don't do this thing. I understand."
Vasilev grabbed the Czech by the lapel with a liver-spotted hand, pulling him close.
"Do this thing for me, please. I beg you. And then, the syndicate is yours. You have my word."
Hatred narrowed the dying eyes again. He pulled the Czech even closer.
"Yes, you will. Or you will suffer for it."
Vasilev coughed again and jabbed the morphine button.
"I'll fetch the nurse."
The Czech sped for the door, secretly hoping this was the last of Vasilev. But he knew better. The man's unquenchable hatred was stronger even than his metastasizing cancer. The only course of action left to him was to complete the damned list. Finish off Senator Rhodes and kill Jack Ryan, Jr. Chapter 7. Near Vucevo, Republika Srpska, Bosnia and Herzegovina. The tour van was packed with 8 happy Germans, outdoorsy 20-somethings, including 2 newlyweds. It barreled south down the 2-lane asphalt road at the legal speed limit, towing a trailer carrying 10 sturdy river kayaks. Forested hills were on either side of the asphalt road. The jagged peaks of the Dinaric Alps loomed in the distance toward the south. The 30-year-old driver, Emir Jukic, was a Bosniak from Sarajevo, and he'd been hauling adventure-seeking tourists to his favorite drop-in spot on the Drina River for several years. In fact, he was the principal driver for Happy Times Balkan Tours. In his years with the company, he had driven passengers as far south as the Greek port of Piraeus near Athens, and transported tourists all the way north to Austria for ski vacation packages. He knew the roads and villages, the mountains and rivers of his native country like the back of his hand. His sparkling dark eyes, an infectious bearded smile, and an encyclopedic knowledge of Bosnian history made him a favorite among tourists, with more repeat customers than any other driver working for the region's most successful tour service. Emir kept a two-handed grip on the wheel, but raised one hand to wave at the 4x4 police vehicle heading toward them. 2 young Serb cops he knew by name. Just last week, he had taken them kayaking with a couple local girls, along with bottles of sparkling wine and grilled sausages on the hibachi he kept stored in the back. All free, of course. The 2 cops smiled and flashed their headlights as they passed, the laughing German tourists unaware of the friendly exchange. A kilometer later, Emir slowed the vehicle onto a dirt track that led down to a wide, flat bank near the river. It was the second day of their kayaking tour, and the group knew the drill. Everyone, including Emir, pulled out their gear, pulled on wetsuits, safety vests, and helmets, and began unloading the stacks of kayaks and setting them near the water. Two of the German girls, tall and muscular, reached for the tie-downs on a kayak up on the highest rungs of the trailer.
"Please, not that one," Emir asked politely. "I don't want you to get hurt."
Shorter than both of them, he had a gentle voice that belied his stocky boxer's build. They happily complied as he helped them unload the one just below it, affirming what every tourist to the area knew. Bosnians were the friendliest people on earth. Minutes later, they were all paddling in the gently flowing turquoise water, Emir leading the way with promises of hot lunches and cold beer waiting for them at a beach 6 kilometers downriver. As soon as they made the first bend, a battered green Škoda Octavia wagon pulled up next to the van. A young man in a blue Denver Broncos t-shirt and tan cargo shorts jumped out of the passenger seat and climbed into the tour van. Moments later, he pulled the van and the trailer with the lone kayak back onto the asphalt and headed north for 6 kilometers to another dirt track, leading to a village deep in the forest on the far side of the mountains bounding the road. The man driving the Škoda was another Bosniak, well-groomed and in his 30s, a chemistry teacher who'd immigrated to Germany and returned in the past year, leaving behind his wife and 2 young daughters for safety. He kept the wagon a discreet distance back from the trailer. The bricks of C4 packed into the kayak on the back of the trailer wouldn't explode without a detonator, owing to the unique nature of the chemical bonds within the explosive and the high amount of inert binding agent. Bouncing the C4 on the pavement or even setting it on fire wouldn't cause it to blow. Only a rapid infusion of high energy from an exploding detonator cord or blasting cap could break those chemical bonds, releasing the enormous stores of energy inside the compound in a violent eruption. The combination of stability and lethality in such plastic explosives made them highly favored by all freedom fighters everywhere, his group especially. It wouldn't be long before the shipment would be put to good use. There was even less concern regarding the 10 kilos of premium Afghan heroin also packed into the kayak. At $50 a gram on German streets, that amounted to $500,000, a nice addition to their operating budget. But still, he was a careful man, and he hadn't survived this long without taking precautions. Inshallah. Heathrow Airport, London. Jack hadn't thought about Paul Brown in a long time, he realized, when he boarded the United flight from Dulles to London 10 hours before, and now he thought about him again as he stepped into the terminal at Heathrow. He and Paul had landed here for a connecting flight to Singapore last year, and spent the better part of a long and frustrating day in this very terminal, waiting for mechanical repairs and a missing flight crew to finally resolve themselves. Cherry had been right. Paul had been a guy worth getting to know. Jack was just sorry he hadn't known him longer. The crowds of passengers shuffling past him on the way to baggage claim had no idea that the portly accountant sacrificed himself to keep the world economy from crashing that stormy night and saved Jack's life. Jack firmly believed now that most of human history was composed of such unwritten chapters, full of nameless heroes known only to God and the privileged few who witnessed their sacrifices firsthand. Paul deserved better than a passing thought from him. Jack recalled the wasted hours the two of them had spent at Heathrow. Jack wished he'd used that time last year to run into the city and see Isabel, a former lover he'd met while on the Iranian assignment, another relationship doomed by the demands of their respective careers. Jack would always put his country first before his personal desires. But a wife, a home, and a couple kids someday were high on his list. Jack thought about that when he was getting ready to board at Dulles. He had another long layover again tomorrow when he landed, and he was determined not to make the same mistake twice. While the flight attendant lectured on the proper deployment of the seatbelt, Jack pulled up Isabel's Facebook page. What he saw felt like a punch in the gut. Isabel cradled her newborn baby daughter in her arms as she stood next to her handsome Anglo-Iranian husband, both of them beaming. A striking couple. For a brief moment, Jack imagined that it was him standing next to her in that picture. Jack scrolled briefly through her posts. His disappointment quickly faded. She seemed to have married a stand-up guy, a banker with impeccable credentials. The two of them appeared to be building an amazing life together. "Good for you," Jack whispered. He was genuinely happy for her. He started to post a note on her page congratulating her on everything, but thought twice about it. No point in putting her in an awkward position where she might have to explain something to her husband that obviously didn't matter anymore. Jack clicked off his phone, feeling a little more than stupid for even looking her up. Why did he assume they could just pick up where they had left off? A few hours and a few fingers of Maker's Mark into the long Atlantic flight, he got the bright idea of contacting an old professor from Georgetown, now teaching at the London School of Economics. He shot Dr. Patrick Costello a text, and to his happy surprise, his former teacher responded eagerly. They set a place and time to meet in London. As soon as Jack passed through customs, he shoved his carry-ons into a storage locker in the baggage area and grabbed a cab for the 40-minute ride into the city. He had 6 hours before he needed to get back to the terminal, and he was determined to enjoy every minute of it. Chapter 8. The narrow pedestrian street was packed with a slow-moving parade of protesters, chanting against tomorrow's visit by Scott Adler, the American Secretary of State. Jack didn't realize that Scott, one of his father's closest advisors, was scheduled to lecture at the London School of Economics' prestigious Department of International Relations. Jack checked his iWatch. He was right on time. He pushed his way toward the school's high-arched doorway where a phalanx of nervous police kept the belligerent crowd at bay. Protesters of every stripe and hue waved signs and shouted slogans against American imperialism, predatory capitalism, Thatcherism. Really? Jack asked himself. White privilege, and a host of other alt-left complaints. Sloganeering like that was typical of college campuses these days, even in Europe. Some of them were true believers, but he'd seen his share of them at Georgetown, and most of them were posers who preferred protesting to the actual heavy lifting of making the world a better place. And for too many of these malcontents, especially the guys, that kind of virtue signaling was designed primarily to enhance their shaky social status, and possibly even to get laid. As Jack neared the doorway, a police sergeant showed him her palm to block his entry. "Business with the school, sir." Just then he saw the familiar smile and shock of silver hair of Dr. Costello as he stepped through the glass doors. "Jack, so good to see you." The professor touched the sergeant's shoulder gently with an "excuse me" as he squeezed past her. The two men shook hands. "You look good, Jack. Staying in shape, I see. You look pretty dapper yourself, Dr. C. Comes with the job. And please, it's Patrick." Dr. Costello was in his traditional priest's black suit coat and white collar, both spotless. Besides being a visiting lecturer at LSE, the shorter, bantamweight priest not only served an inner-city parish church, but also tutored neighborhood kids in math. "Hope you're hungry," Dr. Costello said, pointing the way. "Famished. Good. We're going to my favorite pub. Best shepherd's pie in the city. How's your father?" "Great. Thanks for asking. He sends his best." Senior had taken a graduate course in international political economy with Costello years ago, and had recommended the professor to his son when Jack decided to attend Georgetown, too. "Tell him hello for me, will you? And please let him know he's in my prayers." They chatted briefly, dodging the protesters ambling down the sidewalk, many of whom seemed like only interested spectators. Jack caught sight of flags, banners, lapel pins, hijabs, and tattoos of communists, anarchists, fundamentalist Muslims, and symbols of a dozen other radical causes. Too many faces were covered by the black bandanas of Antifa for Jack's liking. Only cowards hid their faces at public protests. Or criminals. He tensed up a little, half expecting something to happen. Just as they turned a corner, a large protester, 3 inches taller than Jack, shoved a flyer into Jack's chest. His long dark hair was pulled into a ponytail. He had a plain, unremarkable face, but his towering frame and intense gaze intimidated most people. Ponytail's black t-shirt caught Jack's eye, emblazoned with bold white letters that read, "Fuck Fascist America," above an upside-down American flag. "Hey, man, careful," Jack said. "Read that, dude. Join the revolution." Jack recognized the man's California accent. He read the flyer. "Students for a moral order demand that American imperialism stops now. End racist American foreign policy. Impeach the fascist president Jack Ryan. Deport war criminal Secretary of State Adler." "Interesting," Jack said, handing the flyer to Dr. Costello, who chuckled as he read it. "What are you laughing at, old man?" Ponytail said. "So I take it you know President Ryan personally," Jack said. "Yeah, he's a fascist fuck. You're an American, so you know it's true." "Trust me, he's not a fascist. His dad killed fascists with the 101st Airborne at the Battle of the Bulge. What did you ever do for your country?" "Oh, Christ, you sound like you voted for that bastard." Jack's fists clenched, and he stepped forward. "Jack," Dr. Costello said, "let's get some lunch, shall we?" He tugged on Jack's arm, breaking his eye lock with Ponytail. Jack turned to the priest. "Sounds good, Dr. C." "Yeah, go get some lunch with your pedophile friend." Jack's eyes narrowed. "What did you say?" "You heard me. We all know what the Catholic Church is all about. And Hitler was a Catholic, you know." "Hitler persecuted the Catholic Church," Jack said. "Priests and nuns were killed in the Holocaust along with the Jews and a lot of other people who weren't politically correct." The man sneered and pointed a finger at Dr. Costello. "He told you that? That's just a bunch of Vatican propaganda. Right, Padre?" Jack felt the heat rise in his face. "You don't know who this man is, and I don't appreciate you insulting him or my faith." A group of protesters gathered in a loose circle around them now. A few wore the cliché Guy Fawkes masks. Some were clearly high on something. Most were agitated, itching for a fight. Jack knew they were all out of eyesight of the police, who were back around the corner. The odds were stacking up in the wrong direction. But Jack didn't care. "Religion is bullshit, dude. It's the Muzak in the men's room at Macy's. Wake the fuck up! You tell him," someone said and laughed. Dr. Costello said to Ponytail, "If you want to change the world, son, meet me at St. Luke's at 4 o'clock and help me teach algebra to some bright young minds. First of all, I'm not your son. And second, do we teach them algebra before or after we rape them?" "You need to watch your pie hole, Ace." Jack stepped closer, his eyes focused on the man's throat. Dr. Costello smiled at Ponytail. "I'm sorry you're so angry." He turned to Jack. "Come on, the shepherd's pie is getting cold." He tugged on Jack's arm, but Jack didn't budge. "It's not worth it, son," Costello said. Jack turned to him. "But he insulted you, and our faith. Our Lord suffered far more for our sake." He nodded at Ponytail. "And his." "Yeah. You two go run along and find yourself a safe space, while you can. Some of us have work to do." The big man pushed against Jack, but Jack held his ground, jabbing a finger in the man's broad chest. "The truth, you stupid bastard, is that if your fat ass got caught in a sling over here, it would be some God-fearing 18-year-old U.S. Marine who'd be laying it on the line to save your worthless hide. So show some respect for your country and your flag, especially over here." "I don't have a flag anymore, Richie Rich. I wiped my ass with it this morning, and then I burned it." Everything in Jack told him to take the shitbird down, honor most of all. but he also had responsibilities as a Hendley employee, and as his father's son. Dropping this sack of human waste hard onto the pavement with a smashing blow to the temple would feel mighty fine, and would render at least a small service to humanity. But a criminal and diplomatic incident wouldn't do anybody any good, least of all him. And the idea of turning this guy into some kind of hero martyr wasn't very appealing. It took Jack all of half a second to decide to stand down. About the length of time it took for Ponytail to start braying like a donkey at his own foul joke. "Get out of my way," he barked as he brushed past Jack, who suffered the humiliating laughter and catcalls rolling through the crowd following in the big man's wake. Jack stood fixed to the pavement, his blood still boiling. "Free speech is a beautiful thing, isn't it?" the priest said with a snarky smile on his face. "So's a well-thrown punch, Dr. C. You should try it sometime. I'm surprised you didn't." "Me too. You had me worried for a minute, son. I prayed for you. I was never very good at that turning the other cheek stuff." The priest professor tugged at Jack's elbow. "If it was easy, it wouldn't be a virtue." Costello's eyes crinkled with his impish smile. "How about a pint of Guinness, and we talk about old times? First one's on me." Chapter 9 Jack and Dr. Costello spent the next 2 hours catching up over pints of Guinness and the best shepherd's pie Jack had ever eaten. Costello grilled him on his work with Hendley Associates, nodding approvingly as Jack explained the wide range of practical skills and fiduciary knowledge he'd acquired in the field after his stint in Costello's economics course. "You ever think about going back and getting your PhD in finance?" Jack shook his head. "No, not really." For some reason, he'd never considered it as a possibility. His dad had a doctorate, of course, and his mother was an MD, but they were brainiacs. So was his older sister, also a doctor. "You might consider it." "Maybe later. I'm having too much fun now," Jack said. Between his duties for both the campus and Hendley Associates, he just didn't have the time, and the idea of spending more hours behind a desk instead of in a halo parachute didn't appeal to him at the moment. But he had to admit it was an intriguing thought, at least for later. Why not? They finished up and Jack paid the bill for both of them. Outside, they said their goodbyes, promising to stay in touch. Jack hailed a cab for the airport as Costello headed for the tube. Neither paid any attention to the CCTV cameras posted on the lamppost just outside the pub. They were ubiquitous throughout the city. Second only to communist Beijing, London had nearly 500,000 of the surveillance devices monitoring the activities of visitors and citizens alike, including Jack, who for a split second, against his training and better judgment, cast his open face upward to catch a glimpse of a jetliner roaring low overhead before jumping into the taxi. Big mistake. In a city with so many government and private closed-circuit television cameras already in place, the addition of still more of them in crowded public spaces was hardly noticed, let alone regulated. The Iron Syndicate had installed more than 500 such cameras in London, but also operated similar networks in Beijing, Frankfurt, New York, and a dozen other cities. Whatever cameras they didn't own, they were often able to hack through a variety of methods. The first level hack was commercial. The vast majority of CCTV cameras sold in the world were built in just 3 Chinese factories in Guangzhou, each of which was partly owned by a board member of the Iron Syndicate. That provided the organization a back door into every computer chip within those cameras, including the ones deployed on NATO military installations and ships, as well as police and intelligence officers. The second-level hack was human. The Iron Syndicate exploited dozens of compromised individuals within corporate divisions and government agencies around the world, who provided restricted CCTV and surveillance database access, either for a fee or under threat. The third-level hack was the Iron Syndicate's own world-class IT department, staffed with some of the most important private sector and government scientists and technocrats who had originally designed these omnipresent surveillance systems. Whether through back doors they had left behind, or simply through skill or brute force, there were few databases and live feeds that the Iron Syndicate couldn't access around the globe as needed. The recent bonus, though, was the advent of the smartphone. Whether through live camera chat programs like FaceTime or through the new facial recognition software required to access phone use, the smartphone companies had provided billions of new real-time and securely identified faces for the Iron Syndicate to exploit. But the coup de grace was the Iron Syndicate's infiltration into the big social media platform databases, Instagram, Facebook, WeChat, Tencent. By posting billions of selfies every day, ordinary platform users were unwittingly contributing to the world's most dangerous facial recognition and surveillance program on the planet. In all cases, the Iron Syndicate maintained a central processing center in Bucharest, Romania, where images were monitored and evaluated with Dragonfly Eye software, recently acquired through their Chinese affiliates. Dragonfly Eye was an AI-driven facial recognition program deployed by the Chinese government, capable of processing up to 2 billion faces in mere seconds. At the moment, the Dragonfly Eye algorithms were tuned to find a match for Jack Ryan Jr., for whom current photographs were strangely difficult to come by, even by open-source intelligence, or OSINT. It was as if somebody was going to the extraordinary length of constantly scrubbing any digital facial reference to the handsome young American throughout all private and social media. However, after enormous effort, the syndicate had acquired a few degraded images. These were suboptimal, but adequate for the task at hand. By the time Jack's taxi pulled up to the departure gate at Heathrow, his image had been identified by the Iron Syndicate system, and the code red priority alarm triggered. The man on duty notified his shift supervisor by phone according to protocol, but he knew she would have already been alerted automatically. He'd seen only one other code red alarm in the last 5 years. Somebody wanted this guy badly. The surveillance camera that had captured Jack's image was immediately identified and its footage reviewed by hand by the shift supervisor. In short order, she acquired the license plate number of Jack's taxi. As the Iron Syndicate reverted to its automated tracking system and tapped into its network of cameras positioned throughout London, as well as at the major airports and train stations, the taxi was quickly located and footage of Jack entering the airport secured. It took only a few more AI-driven moments to track the American back with his carry-ons, working his way through the security check and then toward his gate, where his flight information and destination, Ljubljana, Slovenia, were secured and transmitted to Unit Black, the field operations wet work team. The supervisor put her best analyst on the Ljubljana airport cameras, though the algorithms would spot Ryan faster than a human eye. The shift supervisor shuddered. She worked for a vast international criminal enterprise, to be sure. But she was a trained software engineer, not a killer. Even within the merciless Iron Syndicate, Unit Black's reputation was fearsome. This Jack Ryan fellow didn't have long to live, and the manner of his death wouldn't be pleasant at all. Chapter 10. Ljubljana, Slovenia. A light rain streaked the small windows as the Embraer 170 jet gently touched the runway. Jack powered up his iPhone as the plane taxied to a stop, 100 yards from the terminal. A text message pulled up on his screen. Meet you in the lobby. Jack deplaned from the narrow-bodied Air France jet onto the tarmac, ignoring the spattering drops in the brief hop over to the wide bus that ferried them to the small terminal of the Ljubljana Jože Pučnik Airport. Heathrow International this was not, but it was perfectly serviceable, more like a regional American airport than an international hub. Unfortunately, Jack's carry-on suitcase was 2 inches too tall and 3 kilos over the weight limit for his air carrier, so he had to check it. The time to retrieve his luggage seemed longer than the flight itself, but customs was little more than a perfunctory nod and a quick stamp of his passport, so it all evened out. The trick with commercial aviation travel, he'd learned over the past few years, was to keep your expectations low and to relax. He was greeted in the airport's small lobby with a broad smile and a firm handshake by his host, Rojko Struna, the 37-year-old owner of the firm that had hired Hendley for the consultation. He had a runner's build and an easy gait. "Mr. Struna, it's a pleasure to meet you." "Only one bag?" "I travel light."
"Good. I'm the same way. My car's close."
Struna and Jack headed for the sliding glass doors and the temporary parking, which was just a few feet from the drop-off. Another advantage to the sleepy little airport. There wasn't enough rain to bother with an umbrella. A security camera was perched on the lamppost just above Struna's SUV, a blue BMW X3. Jack loaded his carry-on and laptop into the back of the BMW, then climbed into the plush black leather passenger seat as Struna pressed the starter button. By the time they pulled onto the southbound two-lane E61, the sky had darkened considerably and the windshield wipers were slapping away a heavy rain. The light traffic sped along nicely, mostly German and Italian nameplates on the cars, with a few Skodas making up the rest.
"Sorry about the weather. We're due for rain the whole week. I was hoping to get you up into the mountains while you were here."
"Well, I've got plenty to do anyway. At least I won't be tempted to leave the office."
"It still might clear up. Around here we say if you don't like the weather right now, just wait 10 minutes.
"If you don't mind my saying, your English is perfect." Jack couldn't detect any Slovenian accent. Not that he knew what that would sound like anyway.
"Thanks. It's my first language. I was born in Newport Beach."
"What's a beach bum from California doing in the Balkans?"
"My parents immigrated to the States just after Tito died in 1980. They opened a pizza joint and a bar and did pretty well. You know, the American dream and all of that."
"That's great. My sister and I both graduated from San Diego State. She went into nursing and I studied computer science." "Which explains your company." Struna's firm was pioneering some of the best medical robotics technologies in the industry. "What brought you here?"
"California is a great place to live, but it's a hard place to raise a family. Too crowded, too expensive, too many taxes. My wife and I have 2 small kids, and I'd come back here for vacations for years, so I knew the place well. Maybe it was my parents' nostalgia or something else, but I really wanted to make a go of it, so here we are."
"So far, so good?"
"As I hope you'll see from our financials."
"I've already seen the preliminaries. You're tearing the joint up. Based on those, I don't foresee any problem with you getting registered on the NASDAQ next year."
"I hope you're right."
"Well, that's what I'm here to find out, one way or the other." Jack glanced out the rain-streaked passenger window. He saw low tree-covered mountains and green fields dotted with the occasional farmhouse. "Slovenia is a beautiful country. This is nothing. Wait until you see the Julian Alps and the Socha River. It will take your breath away." Struna eased into the passing lane to get around a big Mercedes 18-wheeler. "And by the way, thanks for not calling it Slovakia, like a lot of Americans do. That's another country altogether." "Not every American is geographically illiterate, but it's not like I know a whole lot about your country."
"I take it you've never been here before."
"No, but the pictures I found on the web were incredible." "We used to be Europe's best-kept secret. I'm afraid our tourism office is doing too good of a job these days."
"Lots of tourists?"
"The euro goes a long way here, if you have a lot of euros."
"You joined the EU in 2004. How's that worked out?"
Struna smiled cautiously, uncertain if he should be completely honest with the American analyst. "For me and people like me, it's great. We have complete access to markets from here to the Atlantic. But if you have access to them, they have access to you, right?"
Struna nodded. "And therein lies the problem. Big European companies, especially the Germans, have moved in.
and the euro is strong relative to our economy. Some of us are doing pretty well, but others are falling behind. It's hard to become middle class in a globalist environment unless you're very entrepreneurial. Same in the States, Jack said. Too many American companies were chasing cheap labor overseas and importing cheap goods. High-wage blue-collar jobs had been lost in the process, and too many blue-collar folks never made the transition to high-tech, high-wage jobs. Overall, it's been a net benefit, but at a cost. Foreign companies coming in, young Slovenes emigrating out to find better work. As a European, it's a good thing. But as a Slovenian, well, I sometimes wonder. Can't you be both Slovenian and European? In theory, yes. But the reality is that European money and culture are overpowering. Small states like ours will have a hard time maintaining their national identities, which I suppose was the reason the EU was created in the first place. Hence Brexit. Exactly. Don't get me wrong. I still think we gain more than we lose, but the EU must adapt or it might not survive in its current form. The idea of Europe is just that, an idea, beautiful and vague. But identity is deeply personal, specific and concrete. The rain lightened up, the automatic windshield wipers slowed. Do I sound like some crazy nationalist to you? You sound like a man who loves his country, or at least his new country. I have dual citizenship, actually, and I still do love America and all that it did for me. But I have several hundred years of family history rooted in these mountains and valleys. That's hard to let go of. A man's identity is his destiny, don't you think? Yeah, for sure. Jack scratched his chin. He wondered what that meant for his own country, when the definition of being an American was changing so rapidly. What do people think about Tito these days? My grandparents, really anybody who remembers the Tito days, wish they lived in the old Yugoslavia again. Communism is that strong here? Struna laughed. Well, not communism like Stalin and those crazies. It was more like a really progressive social democracy. We could own land, vacation overseas, and had other freedoms that the Soviets didn't enjoy. But it was still a dictatorship. Sure, but a benign one. What my grandparents say is that everybody had a job, everybody got a long vacation, everybody had a relatively good life without having to work 80 hours a week. Nobody was too rich. Well, except for Tito and the elites, of course. But nobody was starving. I'm not saying they're right, but it is a nearly universal longing among the older generation. A lot of American millennials think socialism is a good idea, too, mostly because they don't really know what it is. They just know it's really hard to make it in the current system, and they're looking for alternatives. You know Yugoslavia's history? Only the rough outline. It was a communist state under Tito, and then he died in, what, 1980? Then the wars started in 1991 and didn't end until 2001. Very good. Yugoslavia was a federation of six republics and two autonomous regions, including Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. We declared independence on June 25, 1991, along with Croatia. The Yugoslav army, which was really the army of Serbia, controlled by Milosevic, attacked us, and we defeated them in 10 days and earned our freedom. The Croatians had it worse, but in the end they won their independence too. It was the Bosnians that suffered the most. I read over 140,000 Yugoslavians died in the wars. Yes, but not here, thank God. Almost no Serbs lived here, so Milosevic couldn't claim to be protecting anybody from our aggression like he did in Bosnia. Why were the Yugoslavian wars so vicious? I read stories of lifelong neighbors killing neighbors, friends killing friends. It's strange, isn't it? The only good explanation I've ever heard was that for many years, everybody was a Yugoslavian, and there was peace. But once people started saying, I'm a Serb, or I'm a Muslim, all of a sudden people started seeing their neighbors as others, and all of their problems were because of them. Democracy and identity politics don't work so well together. Is it really that simple? Probably not. What's really crazy is that most families were mixed. I have a Bosniak friend, a Bosnian Muslim, whose grandfather was a Catholic Croat and his grandmother was an Orthodox Serb. Nobody cared about all of that until Milosevic and the Serbs started causing trouble. So everything was caused by the Serbians? Struna shook his head. Maybe they were the cause of the most recent troubles, but believe me, there are 500 years of grievances in this part of the world. Nobody is innocent. The amazing thing is, someone did a genetic study a few years ago. Apparently, Serbs, Croats, and Bosniaks are genetically closer to each other than any other groups in the region. We're just one big, happy Slavic family that keeps murdering each other. And that's just recent history. I won't bore you with the 16th century Islamic Ottoman invasion. So today there is the Catholic country of Croatia, but many Croats still live in Bosnia. And there is the Orthodox country of Serbia, but many Serbs live in Bosnia too. Is that about right? Exactly. And the Muslims are the majority in Bosnia. Nice people. Great food. You should visit Sarajevo sometime. I plan to, actually, when I'm done here. Business or pleasure? Pleasure, sort of. Good. You'll love it. It's a beautiful country, and the people are kind. More Americans should visit there. But a lot of them think the war is still going on, even though it ended 23 years ago. Struna hit his turn signal and eased into the right lane. Your hotel is at the next exit. If you don't mind, let's go straight to the office. There's a lot to do, and not enough time to do it. Are you sure you don't want to rest up first? My grandmother used to say, there's no rest for the wicked, and the righteous don't need any. And I learned a long time ago to never argue with her. She sounds Slovenian. German-Irish, but close. Struna killed his blinker just as the sky opened up again. This time, it poured. Jack sighed. It was going to be a long, wet week stuck in an office. Trieste, Italy. Elena Iliescu loved her work, and she was good at it. She took particular joy in her profession, devoting laser focus and creative energy to each endeavor. Phone calls and other distractions simply had no place. But there was one ringtone the busty girl-next-door blonde always answered. Always. She stabbed out her cigarette on the wall of rough-hewn stone, nude beneath her badly stained coveralls. Yes? I need you. A man's voice. The check. When? Yesterday. She swore in her mind. Romanian, her native tongue. I'm not finished here. I was told what I was doing here was a priority. This assignment is code red. Elena's heart sank. She swallowed her fear. How long do I have? 10 days maximum. Preferably sooner. That isn't enough time for me to scout and plan the op. It has to be. Details to follow. At least tell me where I'm going. Ljubljana. Not her favorite city. Quaint, but boring. At least it was a short drive. A little over an hour by car without traffic. She checked her watch. It was just after midnight. I leave first thing in the morning. Photo and genetic sample as usual? No. You need to bring me his head. His face fully intact. That's straight from the top. What the hell? Elena, you understand what I'm saying? Yes. 10 days. I'll call you when I check into my hotel in Ljubljana. The check rang off. Elena swore again, but this time audibly. She pocketed the phone and marched back into the other room in the dank cellar, lit by a dim bulb hanging from a frayed cord. The naked man duct-taped to the chair was semi-conscious and still whimpering beneath the gag. He shuddered when she entered, sensing her presence rather than seeing her through his blackened eyes, swollen and bloodshot. Brand new jumper cables snaked from a car battery on the floor to the foot of his chair. Her plan was to attach the sharp teeth of the copper battery clamps to his ruined genitals, and then the fun could really begin. Too bad. Elena swept past a table, on top of which was a neatly ordered collection of specialized knives, forged in fire by her own hand. She snatched up the smallest one, her sharpest by far. It's your lucky day, Sanchez. She drew a thin line across his throat. His neck opened up, spitting blood. He bled out quickly in a spasm of terror and pain, dead before she hit the stairs a few minutes later. Lucky indeed. The ancient farmhouse flamed like a druid's torch in the cool night air, fueled by its 300-year-old timbers. Elena caught a last smiling glimpse of the towering fire in her rearview mirror as she made a turn. Time for a hot shower and a stiff drink back at her hotel. She wasn't tired. In fact, every nerve in her body was on fire. Her work had a rhythm, and it had been interrupted. It had been an unsatisfying kill. That left an itch inside her that still hadn't been scratched. She needed to clear her head. She checked the speed dial on her phone for the name of a man she knew in Trieste, a hard and angular Florentine. A few hours in the embrace of the violent, insatiable Signore would be the best thing she could hope for before starting her next assignment. Chapter 11. Near Chitluk, Bosnia and Herzegovina. The night air cooled a little, but not too much, and the breeze off the mountain carried the sharp, sweet tang of the whispering pines. It was fall, but not yet cool, the summer warmth lingering like a lonely cousin in the small rocky valley. The inky black sky shimmered with stars bright in their courses. It was the first September the four teenagers hadn't been in school, and none of them were going to college this year. The boys, fraternal twins, were heading for Split to work in an uncle's restaurant on the Adriatic coast in 2 days. Like other ethnic Croats in Bosnia, all four of them had relatives in the country of Croatia to the west, where there was more work to be had, though mostly for the tourist industry. It was long, grueling labor, but better than no work at all, and the new American tourists tipped like drunken sailors, unlike the Germans. The girls were planning on leaving too as soon as they could find something, somewhere, anywhere. They had their feelers out, but nearly half of all Bosnians were unemployed, and good, steady work with a decent paycheck was scarce, especially in the countryside. The taller girl was good with numbers, but shy, and the fine-boned brunette spoke passable French. They were heading to Sarajevo at the end of the week to start their search. But all of that was for later. The four of them had spent the last 2 days hiking in the hills and swimming in the Lukoch River, roasting river trout on open fires and drinking sweet summer wine, cheaper and better than weed, which was harder to come by, too expensive, and still illegal in Bosnia. Tonight was their last night together, and they turned in early to their respective tents. Summer lovers soon separated, probably forever. They each finally fell asleep, spent and sated, the smell of salty sweat and campfire smoke in their nightclothes. Their deep, rhythmic breathing wasn't disturbed by the crunch of pine needles beneath 8 pairs of heavy boots, and the tall girl woke only when she heard the muffled scream of her friend in the dark, followed by the zip of a blade shearing through her tent wall. The camouflaged men hid their faces behind balaclavas. One of them, the unit commander, stood back in the shadows, his milky left eye glistening in the moonlight, watching the other men bind and gag the four teenagers. They tied the boys to the trees and forced them to watch the gang rape of the two girls, then forced the girls to watch them beat the boys with batons until their bones cracked, before raping them with the same heavy instruments. The four broken bodies were tossed face down onto the pine needles, whimpering and faint. Two men stepped forward, put heavy knees in the center of the boys' backs, pulled their heads up by the hair, and slit their throats. The last thing the brunette remembered before she passed out was a rasping whisper in her ear. Croatia for Croats, Bosnia for Serbs. On a bridge 6 kilometers north of the campsite, the man with the milky eye was dressed in civilian clothes again, as was his driver, their camouflage gear carefully packed and hidden in the back of the unmarked panel van beneath a stack of boxes. His burner phone signal had just 1 bar, but that was enough to call the local police. He reported that he had heard screams in the woods west of Cheatlook, and hung up before he could answer any further questions, then pulled the battery and pocketed it before tossing the remainder of the burner phone into the river below. He signaled the driver to head for home, careful to keep within the speed limit. With any luck, the police would respond quickly. Violent crime was virtually unknown in the area, and cops didn't have much to do, especially this time of night. The milky-eyed man couldn't take the chance that the girls might die from their injuries or exposure before they were found, or that somehow they might fatally harm themselves trying to get back to human habitation. They might even be tempted to commit suicide after such humiliation. No, that wasn't acceptable at all. The plan required them to survive. He was confident the police would arrive in time, and the girls would be found, and their stories told so that the whole country would know what had happened to them tonight, and, more important, who had done it. The man with the milky eye had no regrets about the suffering of the two girls, even though he had three daughters of his own about that same age. After all, what he had done was for them. Chapter 12. Ljubljana, Slovenia. Jack had spent 8 days on his ass, his nose buried in financials and spreadsheets, 3 days longer than he'd planned. That would cut his search time in Sarajevo down to just 3 days. But he thought that might be enough. Gavin had generated a list of potential Aida Koriches, including those who had married and changed their names. Sorting by age and other factors had shortened the list considerably. Tracking them down wouldn't be a big deal. Jack's office window overlooked the parking lot and another glass and steel building in the technology park, each of the last 8 days marred by dark clouds and rain. Strona offered to take him on a walking tour of the small but charming old town, where cars weren't permitted, but he confessed it was mostly restaurants, bars, and small retail shops, so Jack politely passed. He'd rather spend the time finishing up his work as fast as he could, but he would allow himself one day to tour the Julian Alps with Struna, hoping that the weather would break by then. He woke up, sorely disappointed. It was still raining. The night before, Struna took him to Pop's place in the old town because Jack was craving an American-style burger, and frankly, so was Struna. The place was hopping with locals and tourists, with a friendly and animated staff. He and Struna sat at a communal table next to a quiet Belgian couple and a group of rowdy Aussies. The huge selection of local craft beers was amazing and tasty, especially the Bavagond smoked porter, an Austrian brew. The grass-fed Slovenian beef burgers were pretty damn good, too. "You did a great job for us, Jack," Struna said, his red-rimmed eyes smiling as he hoisted an oatmeal stout. "You're gonna be a billionaire," Jack said, toasting his friend. "But you better get some shut-eye. You look pretty beat. No rest for the wicked, right?" Struna smiled and finished his beer, then paid the tab, and the two of them headed for Jack's hotel. Jack was hardly surprised when his phone rang at 5:30 that morning. Struna's clogged voice apologized. His wife and kids were sick, and he wouldn't be able to take Jack to the mountains. Besides, it was still raining. "But if you still want to go, you can take my car. I pre-programmed the GPS for you last night and left a guidebook on the front seat." "If you don't mind, sure." He felt awkward borrowing the man's car, but what the hell else was he going to do? Stay in his hotel room and watch reruns of Say Yes to the Dress with Slovenian subtitles? Triglav National Park, Slovenia. Struna's BMW was a joy to drive, and, fortunately, Slovenians drove on the right side of the road, for which Jack was grateful, given the 24 hairpin curves he traversed on the narrow road to the top of the highest point in Triglav National Park. The good thing about the rain was that almost nobody else was out but crazed mountain bikers, and he seemed to have the place mostly to himself. He listened to an audio guidebook he'd downloaded onto his iPhone the night before. This high country was hallowed ground in many ways, part of the 400-mile Third Front in the Holocaust known as the First World War, where invading Italian troops battled the forces of the Austro-Hungarian Empire to seize Slovenia for Italy. Jack passed battlefield cemeteries crowded with thousands